Hey, good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue, and we have our Roundtable panel assembled, and we are ready to talk about lots of interesting subjects. We welcome you as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Joining us for the discussion is WAMC's Alan Chartok. And good morning, Alan. How are you?
Oh, good morning, Big Joe.
Also joining us is University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo. Hello.
Hello.
And finally, making up our quartet is attending psychiatrist of the Berkshire Medical Center, as well as the medical director of the Breen Center for Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, Dr. Jennifer Michaels. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a delight to have you here. Thank you very much for being with us. Let us talk first about, we have a lot of mental health issues to talk about, of course, because Dr. Michaels is here, and that's what she knows about. So we're gonna focus on a lot of those today. However, let us begin with what happened in Oklahoma yesterday, and still is dominating the news cycle. This is a tragic story. Emergency crews and volunteers continuing to work this morning for survivors of a huge tornado that ripped through parts of Oklahoma City, killing at least 91 people. And at least 20 of them children, and flattening whatever was in its path along the way. And a lot of people trying to just figure all of this out today. A lot of people are still missing. And of course, of the death toll, as much as half of that could be children. So it brings us to the question of how we learn to deal with something like this. Those of us who are, of course, those who are in Oklahoma who are directly affected, and those of us who are watching from afar, but with great horror as we see what nature can do. And I guess, Dr. Michaels, the other thing is you think about what of how we can cope with something that comes from nature as opposed to something like Newtown or
Boston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think we go into survival mode. And so the people closest to the area of damage are in fight or flight mode. And they will deal with the trauma, the emotional scars later on. And we're more on the periphery. So we're dealing with some of the fear, the sense of being overcome. That they're probably not even able to do right now.
So we project ourselves into that sort of Jen, things like, my God, you know, I have kids. And what if these were my kids in this elementary school? And it extends out to us?
Yes, that's exactly what happens. We put ourselves there because we're human beings and we have compassion.
So how do you treat somebody who is the victim, the family of a child, or a child who is, you know, whose father or mother or both get killed? How do you do that?
Well, you know, initially it's about truly survival. It's about having a place to live, having clothes, having food. And so once those basic needs are met, providing a place for people to talk, to connect with other people who have gone through traumatic events is helpful. And it can take years, obviously, to process this. So it's something that unfolds and will work out over time.
A reporter friend of mine is there. She's a photographer, and she's taking pictures and talking about what an incredible mess it is to cover this. It's just complete devastation in areas. And for reporters, this is a problem. And we talked a little bit about this before the show. They also face a sort of trauma covering this. And the people they have to talk to are the ones most directly affected. So we're going in and asking invasive questions at a time when they probably are least able to handle them.
So what are you? I'm sorry, Joe. So what do you do about that? In other words, reporters have to do their jobs, obviously.
Yeah.
And yet, the thing most reporters will tell you that they hate the most is sticking a microphone in front of somebody's face and say,
"How does it feel to have your house knocked down
by
a killer storm?"
Like, you know, what's an invasive question?
What happened to your child? You know, what did you lose in the house? All the basic questions. What's the property damage you have? And every one of those is painful to someone who's been through it. I know that there is in journalism a movement started by the DART Society, which was founded by an excellent reporter who was himself the victim of a trauma. He was in a coffee shop when a madman came in and started slashing and cutting people. And he was seriously injured. And as a result of that, he started this group that studies how journalists can do their job, as you put it, and talk to people of trauma, but without, you know, inflicting even more harm on them. And it has to do with more listening, asking questions like that you would ask to someone who was a friend who had gone through this, rather than a subject of a story, and then sitting back and let them tell it at their own pace. But still, it's the most difficult of reporting.
Well, you know, Joe's point about invasive, the question about what's invasive is, you know, so interesting, because we do know what sells newspapers. And, you know, you want something that's poignant.
Tell me about your cat spinning around in the high winds, you know, something. You're looking for anecdotes and examples and details, and those are the very things that are going to make someone who's just been through this recall it all and relive it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a delicate balance. And we see this in psychiatry, where we'll say you don't have to talk about the details because it can activate you in a way that's terrifying. So part of recovery is learning how to feel safe, how to ground, how to connect with your old activities. So too much of these invasive questions are no good in psychiatry, and I would assume in journalism too.
No, I think probably just the opposite.
I
think, I think the psychiatric approach is the cure.
Mm-hmm. The report, ours is to get those details. Yeah,
is to get the stuff to sell the story, sell the bananas or whatever you're doing.
Well, I'm advocating for the victim who
may be
further traumatized by those questions. And also I read the paper and I want the details, so I can see both sides of it. That I want to know that story. I want to hear the details, and yet the person you're asking may be
very unable to talk about it.
Or maybe further traumatized if they are asked to relive a traumatic event again and again.
So you're causing harm. So, I mean, there are ways around this. Like, you talk to a relative of the family. If I were in this situation myself, I would be thinking, of course, of the journalist, because that's what I am. But I wouldn't want me or my kids to be talking to the journalist.
There also seems
somebody who knows me.
There also seems to be a need for those on the direct periphery who have lost their homes and maybe not, who have not lost a child or lost a loved one, but they have a want and a need to talk.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, they're seeking out reporters to tell their stories, too, of what they've, and that's part of the process as well. And
what do you think that's about?
I think it can be therapeutic if they're telling a story versus being probed with many questions. Mm-hmm. It can be cathartic to have an opportunity to talk about what you've been through.
Mm. Typically what you'll hear from, and we saw it in Newtown, was someone who had accomplished something. They saved a life, or they found their child alive, and so they could talk about that, and they were happy to talk about it, and then also relay some of the misery of the people around them not so lucky.
Well, last night on CNN, they were saying that people were coming in and were calling CNN to tell them about their reunions of people that they had found, that they wanted to share. That reunion. They wanted to share the stories of what had happened, because it felt good.
And I like the idea that the person gets to tell their story versus being asked many questions. I think that allows them to choose what they're sharing. I also wonder about the reporters and their trauma. I mean, I don't know if we look at that when reporters are witnesses to death and devastation. Do they have support groups?
This is increasingly a focus of the DART Society, and they look at rather than a
society thing.
It's called DART, DART. It's based out of Columbia University, and the whole focus is just what we're talking about: how journalists trying to do their jobs cannot inflict harm while getting these important stories out. And it makes me a little nervous to be concentrating on journalists when you have, you know, people killed, families who have lost their homes. Mm. I mean, they are the real victims, and that's where the focus ought to be. But good journalists, they they definitely get involved in there. If you cover a war zone or a post-war society, certainly you get caught up in that.
But there's also an avoidance here. I know Joe's going to have to take a break here, but there's also an avoidance of, you know, another question, which is we're getting more and more of these thousand-year events. And we think that one of the reasons is, at least I think and a lot of scientists think, it's because of the global warming issue. And that, again, here's a psychiatric question for you, Dr. Michaels. We're putting our heads in the sand rather than doing, we're avoiding it rather than tackling it. And people are saying it's just not true and all the rest of it. And by the time it's all over, we may be too late.
Well, denial is very powerful. Yeah. And it works really well until you're overcome by the evidence. And, it's a coping mechanism that many people employ. And I think that may be happening now.
After Joplin and now Oklahoma City, you have to start looking at whether denial works.
We're going to continue our conversation. We're going to take a quick break and continue this conversation. Then we'll have many other topics to discuss after the news break at the bottom of the hour. You are listening to our roundtable panel. We always welcome your thoughts. Roundtable at WAMC.org.
Support for WAMC comes from Hudson Valley Foot Associates, podiatric physicians and surgeons treating foot problems with offices in Ulster, Dutchess, Columbia, Orange, and Delaware counties. HVFA.com. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center, a master's in social work program teaching students to address the emerging needs of society. Adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. And Brown & Brown Attorneys at Law, 11 Century Hill Drive, Latham, New York, providing professional legal services to help guide individuals and families through the process of buying or selling a home. brownandbrown.biz.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. I am Joe Donahue along with Alan Chartick, Rosemary Armeo, and Dr. Jennifer Michaels. We welcome your comments at roundtable@wamc.org. We are talking about the tragedy in Oklahoma for the first part of our panel this morning, and it is obviously a tragic event. We're waiting to hear. I know the president is expected to speak at 10 o'clock, but we have not received word as to whether NPR will be covering that or not, because it's been about 4 hours and they don't make decisions that quickly. Anyway,
Rosemary just brought up a very important point in the break.
Dr. Michaels was talking about we're a compassionate people, so we put ourselves in the place of people who have suffered in Oklahoma City, and two of those people will be the senators from Oklahoma who are fiscal conservatives and who have voted against aid to the storm Sandy that hit New York and New Jersey, and they did this in the name of we can't afford to help these people. And now, of course, it's all reversed. And I presume that there'll be a vote soon on whether to help people in Oklahoma. And I hope it's positive, as the way it should be for all of these incidences.
How do you vote now?
I have no
to
idea.
To help
it's
people
so unfair.
From a natural disaster.
Right. And especially as Alan was saying, we can probably expect more of those. We're seeing more of those.
I was struck, Dr. Michaels, by a recent story from that I was watching in 60 Minutes with the parents of the victims of the children from Newtown, and of course the story itself is obviously tragic and just gripping and heartbreaking. But the mechanics of how it is set up, of where parents are brought in to wait for news and the people who are on hand, and it seems as though, and this was the case here as well once it was learned that a school was directly affected, it seems as though we've gotten better at that, haven't we, of that direct response of knowing how to deal with those who are directly impacted, whether children are involved or not. This would be something that we would have an emergency station. We had it in Boston as well. We would have it if an airliner disaster, whatever, where we have these centers that are set up for those who are waiting for news.
I think we have done better. And I think after 9/11, we began to create specialty training for crises, and there are groups that are trained to go in these situations and help with the mental health issues. I mean, they don't do the physical work. They deal with the emotions, you know, the extreme emotions, the distress that people are experiencing, and they're crisis teams.
Hmm. But you always hear about these crisis teams in schools. Crisis teams will be available to talk to the parents. Crisis teams will be available. Look, you're a superb psychiatrist. Your reputation precedes you, you know, everywhere. How
sweet.
How much can these crisis teams know in terms of making people adjust better?
Well, you know, crisis teams, I worked with our crisis team last night at Berkshire Medical Center. I was on call. And that's what they do. And sometimes it's very fundamental, like making a phone call to a loved one. Mm. You know, when people are in an extreme traumatic event, remembering a phone number is impossible. Mm. Talking on the phone is too much.
Right.
Trying to recall, you know, where they live, or even driving a car is overwhelming. So they help. They can help with the fundamentals. They can help to connect them to other supports, get a good friend sitting next to them. So a lot of times it's not working through the event. It's surviving. It's taking one step forward.
And it's better than nothing. I mean, in the sense of going that alone.
Yes, it's much better. And then oftentimes what the crisis team will do is meet with you at 10 in the morning, check in with you at 3 in the afternoon. They'll be there in the evening, and the next morning they're there too. So they get you through a crisis.
So how are you defining crisis in this case? I'm struck by what you just said, that you worked with the crisis team last night at Berkshire Medical. You can't tell us individual cases, obviously, but when do you get called in?
Yeah, what kind of cases are you?
Well, people are in distress. So unfortunately, about 1 o'clock last night, I went into the hospital, and someone who was having suicidal thoughts needed to be hospitalized. And so the crisis team at Berkshire Medical Center and the Breen Center will talk to that person, evaluate them, look at their history, and then with me make a decision about how to best help them. And that happens every day, not just at BMC, but around our country. And we're very fortunate that we have crisis teams like that. So they're manned in the emergency room, but they're also out in the community. They're mobile. They're 24/7.
You see the difference in a place like Bosnia, where I worked, that went through a horrendous war and genocide, and they don't believe there. It's a very traditional economy. They do not believe in psychiatric help. That's a Western idea. And it's as if we Westerners have described it this way, and they were insulted. The whole country suffers from post-traumatic stress syndrome. You know, you cannot talk to anybody about any topic without hitting the war two sentences in. And these people have never been allowed to grieve, to go through the whole process as your crisis teams help.
And they do really help. I mean, so here you have a country that is kind of in suspended animation, in trauma mode, and it needs to heal. You know, it can still survive, but the quality of life, the feeling of safety is impacted.
It's gone, sure.
And, you know, it also speaks to the stigma of mental illness, because, you know, if there were broken legs in that country, everyone would have a leg set. You know, they'd see a doctor, an orthopedic surgeon, whatever.
That's a good point. They are actually, the Bosnians were actually insulted when we Americans were talking about, you know, you have stress, you have PTSD. No, we're not like crazy Vietnam soldiers. That's their image of it. It is a stigma.
Yeah, and that makes me very sad, because it's very treatable. It's comparable to where breast cancer was 30 or 40 years ago. I mean, I remember working at Bellevue Hospital, and women came in with the most advanced cases. They obviously had been suffering for years and years, but because they were ashamed, they were stigmatized, they came in with fatal cases of breast cancer. And now you have women on billboards,
right, books,
you have, you know, Save the Boobies and things like that. So my hope is that mental illness, which is so marginalizing, stigmatizing, becomes
mainstream,
because it's really common. About 26% of Americans will have some form of a mental illness in any given year. Now, that may be a phobia. You may be looking at me now and saying, what do you mean that, you know, 26%? But could be insomnia, phobia, could be depression. It's really common. It's more common than high blood pressure.
I'm going to hit the pause button right there. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll pick up exactly where we left off because we want to talk exactly about some of those stigmas and many of those other issues. We'll be back. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Coming up next, a news update from National Public Radio. Welcome back to our roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here, as is Rosemary Armeo, who is a University of Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter. Also joining us this morning is our special guest, Dr. Jennifer Michaels of the Breen Center for Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, as well as the attending psychiatrist at Berkshire Medical Center. And it's a great pleasure to have you with us. As I said, press the pause button right before our news break because we were talking about stigma in mental illness, and you were making the comparison to breast cancer several decades ago. What do you think it's going to take to change that stigma?
That's a really good question because we haven't been successful so far. I mean, we are educating the public. I think we need some survivors of mental illness who are going to stand up and talk about it. We're starting to get some of that, but not a lot.
What is a survivor of mental illness?
Well, someone who has suffered from something like bipolar or substance use disorder or schizophrenia, and the disease is in remission, and they become advocates, role models for other people, guides to show them how to work on recovery.
Hmm. But it is interesting, isn't it, that that we see people who have bipolar and who have been taking medication and who are really in the mainstream. In other words, in the old days, I suspect before the pharmacological revolution that we've gone through, the medicines really weren't always that good. And now we have stuff that people take this medication as if they have a cold.
It works. Yeah, yeah, we're very fortunate because we now have a lot of options and they work. And they work so well, Alan, that sometimes people feel like they don't need them anymore. And that's a problem.
That's when the disaster happens.
Yeah.
Well, right. So, you have to understand you live with that, right? That's what it takes. You have to have that in your toolkit to go on.
There's a feeling, definitely among journalists who cover these stories, that people are using bipolar especially, or mental illness like sex addictions, addictions, as an excuse for wrongdoing. Whenever they're caught, they'll immediately say, oh, you know, I have a problem. I'm going to go into therapy. Does that hurt your cause?
I think that there are trends in diagnosing, and it can become trendy to have a sex addiction or to have bipolar disorder. But, you know, these are true illnesses with specific criteria, and I think it can be misused. It can be used as an excuse. My hope is that we keep it professional and medical. People can blame their illness, whether it's real or not.
So what about you? I mean, obviously, you're the person on the spot responding to Rosemary's question. You get called into the jail, you get called into the hospital, and you've got to make the call as to whether you've got a faker on your hands or whether you've got somebody who is who's truly bipolar or truly sex addicted. And you are an expert in addictions.
I am, and I have to say, the vast majority of people are not faking. You know, we hear these sensational cases of people who...
Tiger Woods,
you know, go to the media, you know, I didn't know what I was doing, I'm a sex addict. The vast majority... I think he knew what he was doing. the vast majority of people are suffering from true mental illness. And I have learned from my patients. You said I'm an expert because my patients have taught me what true mental illness looks like and true addiction looks like. And very few people are faking.
Here's one other thing that I think leads to the public not really believing in mental illness, and those are trials. Whenever you have someone who's committed a heinous crime, you have experts on the defense side and on the prosecution side, and they argue the same thing about the same person, which leads to the idea that it's all baloney.
And it muddies the water. It really muddies the water.
So that if a psychiatrist is for sale, You know, okay, they've got theirs, we'll find ours, we'll pay him, and he'll or she'll do whatever we want them, whatever we want them to. And that doesn't garner a lot of respect for the issue.
Yeah, it raises suspicions about the whole feel and the whole idea of mental illness. Anybody who's done something wrong and got caught will say, I'm mentally ill. I think that's...
You know, that's a minuscule slice of psychiatry, but it does exist.
Sure.
And it's also the part that we hear in the media. But the day-to-day workings of psychiatry is treating people who have real illnesses and who are suffering and can get better.
So if you have to diagnose somebody, secrets of a psychiatrist, if you have to diagnose somebody who is, you know, you say, my patients have taught me what addiction looks like. What does addiction look like?
Good question.
What does addiction look like? Well, first of all, no one has come to my office and has said, you know, I really always wanted to be a heroin addict. The way addiction looks is someone accidentally got addicted to something and then couldn't stop. And during that path, on that path, they lost things, whether it's their spouse, their education, their physical health, mental health, and the compulsion to use would override all of these very important vital parts of life. So they've lost a lot. They can't stop using. They're sick. They're suffering.
So what accident? You say accidentally.
Can I zoom out on that?
Sure.
So if you take of why we're using, of whatever it is, if it's alcohol or it's prescription drugs or it is street drugs, we're using something to treat ourselves, aren't we, in some way, to alter the way that we feel?
Well,
I mean, is there a baseline of panic and anxiety and disorders that most of us are trying to deal with that puts us into that position of like a baseline for addiction?
Mm-hmm. I think that's one risk factor, but most people are just experimenting.
So that's the accident when they're experimenting?
Yes, and maybe that's a bad term. I will live to regret saying accident, experimenting. So one out of six high school seniors will experiment or try an opiate pill like Vicodin or Percocet to see what it's like. For fun, to get high. And a percentage of those seniors will end up escalating their use and getting addicted and get so addicted they can't stop.
Now, you've talked in the past on Medical Monday about some of these drugs, marijuana being one or other things, becoming entry drugs. You know, in other words, that you start with that and then it gets worse. You know, you're not a trendist. You don't go along with the trend that it's okay to smoke marijuana. You think it's a bad thing, don't you?
Well, I just to answer the first question, I think what you're bringing up is the gateway hypothesis, that if you start smoking marijuana, you will then graduate to stronger drugs.
Or you might.
You might. You might or you might not. And it looks like actually cigarette smoking is a better predictor of graduating to other harder drugs. But it's not just because you smoke marijuana. It's that you may come from a low socioeconomic background. You may have a lot of stress in your life. There are many factors that lead to heavy drug use. So it's unfair to pin it on marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question about being anti or pro marijuana, my big concern is marijuana use in people under age 21. Because that's when their brain is forming. That's when they're wiring their brain for life. And they will wire their brain for addiction if they are exposed to a lot of substances.
So with that said, one of the issues that we want to discuss today was marijuana. And this is something that obviously has been used for pain relief for thousands of years, as you note. And if you have 50% of Americans supporting legalization of marijuana and certainly a state by state checking off the list of looking into medical marijuana, where does that leave this for all the questions that you and Alan have just been talking about?
Well, I agree with you that the majority, a small majority of our country supports legalization of marijuana. And so we're entering into a social experiment. And I think it's an opportunity for us to better understand the chemicals, the medicines within marijuana. So it's been illegal since the 1930s. We've been using it for 4,000 years, and we're in our infancy in understanding how it works.
That's really fascinating. And yet alcohol and tobacco, which we are much more aware of the deleterious effects, we don't control. We don't control it
and
all
aspirin.
Legally.
an aspirin. So let me give you an example. We have the cannabis plant. There are over 85 cannabinoids. A cannabinoid is a substance like THC. There are over 85 of these different substances that bind to our brain cannabinoid receptors.
Wow. I like that name.
Yeah.
Cannabinoid. I have a few more that I'll throw
good.
Out if you'd like.
Excellent. I would
like
love
endocannabinoid.
Oh.
You like that too? So we have over 85 cannabinoids in the cannabis plant. One is THC. THC is responsible for the euphoria, the high, the anxiety, the sometimes hallucinations.
Hunger.
Okay. Hunger, increased hunger. That's one. Another one is cannabidiol.
Oh boy.
I like that.
Okay,
term.
Get ready. No psychoactive effects. Doesn't get you high. Relieves pain.
Wow.
Diminishes nausea. We have an opportunity. I think marijuana will be legalized the way things are going. We have an opportunity to
single that out.
Really slice out all of these different components of cannabis. And I'm really interested in cannabidiol as a treatment for pain management, especially because it's not psychoactive.
Wow.
What does that mean?
It's
I'm sorry, psychoactive.
Means that it gets you high. Sorry, Alan, it gets you high. So what I'm saying is there are so many different substances.
Yeah, you have to use street terms with that.
Yeah, okay, yeah. He's a bright man, but we're going to dumb it down.
You gotta get him.
Yeah, I get it. I have to tease you, I'm sorry.
The language of the hood, please. It's Alan.
I accept that.
Okay.
So, because I can understand it, then so can everybody else. So it seems to me there are two issues here on this marijuana thing. One of them is it harmful? Is it a gateway? Is it this or that? The other is Al Capone. In other words, by creating this industry, this marijuana industry around the country, have we created, an underground that is really very harmful to the country? Are we better off making it accessible so that we don't have the crooks making out like bandits as a result of this?
Mm-hmm. We put Mexican cartels out of business to a certain extent.
Yeah. Although they'll find something else.
Oh, yes, they will. They have other drugs.
Well, and my question is if you alter the plant so that you're not getting the high, aren't people still going, and that becomes legal, aren't people still going to look for the plant that gets them high, which would still be illegal?
Well, it may become legal, though. So my hope is that we cultivate plants for pain relief and use that medicinally, okay? And that if marijuana becomes legal, that has a different component, a higher THC component, that we really get smart about the science versus having medical marijuana that we smoke and we have these 85 chemicals and we really don't know what they do. My hope is that we add some science to our passion about marijuana.
But don't you think there's a political aspect to this? Not to, in other words, don't you think that there are lots of people in our society who are committed to being bad? I don't mean bad.
No
with,
one at this table.
Bad with quotes around it. It's a way of acting out. It's a way of rejecting the political mores. That is one of the reasons that marijuana has become such a hot political issue, because it is a revolutionary concept. I'm going to smoke this pot, and I don't give a damn what you say.
But doesn't that go back to alcohol too, which was also political at one time? We tried banning it, and it certainly did not stop alcohol
use. No, it made it worse.
Yeah.
That's the whole Capone pit.
And in many ways, marijuana is not difficult to get. It's freely available,
So because there's a secondary economic system that delivers the stuff.
So isn't it smarter then to deal with it the same way we do with alcohol, which is it's legal, but you do a lot of educating about how to use it well and how to abuse it.
And they still have tens of thousands of people dying on the roads.
And you arrest people, who are high, right?
For using it.
And we have to figure some things out. Like, how do we monitor THC or marijuana use and look at intoxication? Because we can breathalyze someone with alcohol. That doesn't work with THC or marijuana. So we have some work to do. But if the majority of Americans want to legalize it, I think it's a matter of time. I could be wrong. I just hope that we use it as an opportunity to understand the chemical better. So, for example, many people don't know this, but cocaine is a legal substance in our country. It's scheduled by the DEA, and it's a Schedule II, meaning that it can legally be used for things like anesthesia or control of bleeding. Marijuana is a Schedule I drug in the same class as LSD and heroin. So because it's Schedule I, it's illegal, has no medicinal value currently, according to the DEA, we can't even study it.
That's crazy.
Yeah, we're in a bind. You know, we really need to learn more about this substance.
So how do we get to the medical marijuana and having it pass in states if we're not studying it?
I think that that's kind of a stepping stone to legalization. That's my understanding.
Sure.
It's kind of a wink-wink. It does have medicinal value. It helps with things like...
But isn't that the cart before the horse about studying it before you make it legal?
I think we're voting with our emotions and perhaps not with all of the knowledge.
We have to take a break. We will be back with our conversation in just a moment. We welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org.
Support for WAMC comes from Performance Automotive Pittsfield, a European and Saab service center serving Western Massachusetts and the greater Albany market for 25 years. Saab, it's not just a car, it's a passion. SaabPerformance.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Painter Edith Hunsberger exhibiting watercolor and acrylic paintings at Paradise City in Northampton, Massachusetts, Memorial Day weekend, May 25th through 27th, edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And United Way of the Greater Capital Region, Albany, New York, investing in education, financial stability, and health, unitedwaygcr.org.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. Dr. Jennifer Michaels is with us. She is with the Breen Center for Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services in the Berkshires and is also the attending psychiatrist of the Berkshire Medical Center. And it's a great pleasure to have her with us. Also, of course, Alan Chartok and Rosemary Armeo. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We've been talking a lot about marijuana for the last couple of minutes. You were talking about breathalyzers. It seems, and I don't know if this is anecdotal or not, but it seems that in what I read and what I see of problems, the prescription drug abuse is becoming epidemic in some ways. And how do you get that under control?
That's been going on for a while. And epidemic is a good word. The CDC actually calls our opioid misuse problem an epidemic. It is.
What are the opioids?
Opioids are things like Vicodin, Percocet, oxycodone. Those are the pill forms. And heroin is an opioid. And we have natural opioids like our endorphins in our brain. And those opioids, the opioid pills, will hijack our natural endorphin system. They just bind to those receptors and activate them orders of magnitude greater than we could ever do naturally. And that's why, you know, this addiction is so compelling.
So they calm us. They free us from pain. They put us out of any quote-unquote misery that we have of that moment, yes?
Yes, and at high doses, they stop our breathing.
So that's an accidental issue.
That's an accidental.
That's so much fun, yeah.
You know, which is that I had a back operation. My very good doctor gave me OxyContin, of which I have had none because it has such a bad reputation. I'm scared of it. You know, I'm not going to touch it during that time. But it's hanging around all over the place. I turned it in. I'm just lying here. I turned it in so that nobody would come into my house and grab it.
That sounds good. You know, there are now drug roundups, and they're held in police stations because people don't know what to do with their pills. And you're a good person, but we knew that already.
I'm lying.
I don't know. We'll do the polygraph after this. But if you ask teenagers about how available these pills are.
Yeah.
The vast majority say they're easily available from friends and family and from medicine cabinets.
Interesting.
You don't need to go to a dealer to get these pills until you're so addicted you've used up all the other resources.
On the campus, Adderall is the prescription drug favored for abuse because it increases your concentration and it helps you. It's an upper. It keeps you going all night. And the students there say the same thing. It's easy to get a prescription. If not, it's easy to find friends who have a prescription and they share.
Well, that's the other thing, and we'll end with this, because it is in our prescription drug culture. We have, I believe this is correct. It was about a year ago that the nightly news programs have their number one advertiser is prescription drug companies, the pharmaceutical companies, mm-hmm. Which I find interesting. So if you're a news junkie, you're on something. So I don't know. It's odd. But if you have that. If you have that culture, because and every one of those ads says, ask your doctor for. Mm-hmm. So as Rosemary just said, if I know what the symptoms I have to have to get that, and I go to my doctor and I say, I have this, and I walk out with that piece of paper. So what do we do about that to determine whether that piece of paper is necessary? Mm-hmm. And then once you have that prescription, who oversees it to make sure that it's not
diverted,
going in the wrong hands and is being looked at.
We're just catching up with this problem. So there are efforts in action now. So there's a prescription monitoring program, for example, that will allow me, if you came into my office, would allow me to tap into your prescribing for the past year and see if seven other doctors gave you the same prescription. Mm. Have you been doctor shopping? So we're beginning to put different, are you diverting?
Right.
We're just beginning to put things like that in place. So we have a lot more work to do.
Does it annoy you when a GP will give a prescription for an antidepressant or an anxiety drug?
I think it's fine for very simple depression or anxiety. A GP knows the patient, and if they're comfortable doing that, that's fine. I do get annoyed when a GP gives 120 OxyContin for a back pain problem.
Right.
That really annoys me.
But, of course, it's very hard to get to a psychiatrist such as yourself, I think. We get these calls on Medical Monday. How do I do it? How do I get there? So the GPs are really the last line of defense in many cases.
But my issue is that if you're dealing with depression, or you're dealing with anxiety, or you're dealing with bipolar, that shouldn't it be through someone where therapy is also a part of that prescription to get better?
I think that's the ideal. I think because we have a shortage of medical care, sometimes people get help with their GP. And if it's a very uncomplicated, mild depression,
but it's
or
drug
anxiety,
help and not...
Not the therapy help.
Not the therapy help.
The ideal is combined therapy.
Right.
I agree with you. But not everyone has access to that. Hmm.
My sister, who deals with cancer patients, worries about the thing that you brought up, Alan, which is that people who legitimately are prescribed these pills are afraid to use them, or
right.
they'll cut back, or they'll use less than is prescribed. And her mantra is, you need the pills, use them, they work. And I think you agree with that as well. No?
I do. And we could become guilty of what we call opioid phobia,
right?
Which is we're so afraid we get addicted that we don't use any pain medication.
Mm.
But... You know, that's the flip side.
We are out of time, but obviously these are subjects we'll bring you back if you
want
to come
back.
Excellent.
The more the better.
We love having you here. Dr. Jennifer Michaels of the Breen Center and attending psychiatrist at the Berkshire Medical Center. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Alan, Rosemary, thank you as always.
Welcome to Jim.